Today we're going to talk about some exciting ways to, some exciting research in an area of great interest to me, the education of exceptional children. There are many, many areas of research that are active these days that are hotter than this fire. And we're only going to talk about a few that I've selected because I think they might be sort of interesting to you. And we'll have plenty of time at the end so that if you've heard of some technique that you want to talk about, we can do that. To begin with, let me give you a small mini overview of what we call the sensory hierarchy. Because in the education of handicapped children, we frequently emphasize one sense that the child may have intact. For example, if the child is blind, we may emphasize the hearing process because that's the one that is intact, or vice versa, if the child happens to be deaf. Most of us, probably all of us, have our own sensory hierarchies in this shape right here. You want to remember it like I do, with an acronym, you can call it VACTOG, V-A-K-T-O-G. And it means that most of us, as adults, have our own sensory hierarchies with vision as the sense we use most often and most flexibly, then audition, then kinesthesis, which is movement, tactuality or tactile, which is touch. And lots of times people confuse the two. One is movement, kinesthesis, and when you finally move and touch the thing, then you're in tactile. Olfactory, which would be smell, and gustatory, which would be taste. Now for the infant, mom nature or father nature reverses the thing. Because, as I pointed out last week, the infant has more active live nerve endings in his mouth than anywhere else on his body except in his cerebral cortex. That's the way embryonic development occurs. Consequently, at birth, the child can get more kicks, more joy, out of more happiness, I guess would be a better word, out of his mouth than he can in any other way, because there are more nerve endings there. And that's why you'll see a young child swishing mush around in his mouth, putting things into his mouth, because there are lots of nerve endings there. Mothers and fathers have to watch out. They don't put things in their mouths they're not supposed to. But there's a lot of nerve endings there. Now, as we become adults, the sense of smell and the sense of taste become kind of luxuries for us. We enjoy them when we have a good fire, or when we eat a good steak, or for lots of other things, but they aren't very necessary, and so they kind of drop to the bottom of our pile. And vision and audition, which is much more useful because we have to read and talk and listen, become established in a hierarchy. Okay, on to some of the teaching techniques that are being researched these days and what they're showing. The area of the blind has always been a very active one. Blindness is a condition that obviously very serious, and services for the blind have been around in this country longer, I suspect, than any other service for handicapped people. Now, one of the things that slows a blind person down, besides his ability to move around, is ability to get information. If it's true, in fact, that as adults, a lot of what we get comes through vision, if the blind person doesn't have that, we have to resort to alternative means of getting that information into him. Obviously, we can resort to audition. We can, and we do, put an awful lot of stuff on tapes and records and cassettes. Almost every city of any size at all has in its library a talking book service. You've probably all heard of it. Talking book is nothing more than the tape equivalent of a book. And there are hundreds of people around the country who volunteer to read the latest, most interesting stuff, both textbook as well as novels and other kinds of material, onto tape, which are then given out free to a blind person, delivered to his home, literally, and along with a cassette recorder or phonograph that he can use to play it back for himself and get the content. Another way that blind people have of getting information, of course, is Braille. And I want to spend just a little time about talking about Braille, because that's always been a fascinating thing to me, and I think it probably has been to most people, because it's extremely interesting to think about people getting information off those embossed dots that stick up from the page. How do they do that? There's an awful lot of research in that area, and one of the reasons there is a lot of research is that reading Braille is very slow, because you have to use kinesthesis and tactuality. You have to use movement and touch. Consequently, if you're going to put something, let's say you're going to take the Bible and put it in Braille, the Bible itself is a document about normal size. If you put it in Braille, it would wind up to be about that thick probably, and would probably be about 6 volumes, and the pages would be about this size. And the reason for that is because in changing little words into Braille, you literally have to take more space for it. And you have to put more space between words so that people, as they read them, can discriminate one word from another. And that becomes time-consuming. People who have studied Braille reading find, for example, that fully 7% of the time of someone who's reading Braille is consumed in what they call scanning, which means going from the end of the line on the right back to the line on the left, because we read across this way, don't we? And 7% of your time as a blind reader, if you were reading in Braille, would be spent going back across the page to the beginning of the line. Well, that's a long time. That's a lot of time wasted. So one of my colleagues at the University of Wisconsin got the bright idea that instead of putting Braille up on traditional pages, he would literally take the pages and cut them off, each line, and put them in a continuous loop, which is what this little line drawing is to represent. So now, instead of the person reading across the page with one hand, well, as I should point out to you, most good Braille readers would read with both hands, which may come as a surprise to you. And they're really extraordinarily facile and good at it. But let's suppose that you imagine now, instead of reading like this now, all you need to do is lay your fingers, or one hand, or however you're best at reading Braille, on the top of a little gate here, and the Braille, because it's on a continuous strip now, will pass through the machine, be wound up here, just like a motion picture projector, and so you won't have to move your hands at all. You can just literally hold them there, and the Braille will move underneath. You can also control the speed of the machine. You can speed it up or slow it down. It turns out that people who do this, blind people who do this, if you study them before and after, don't learn more from this method, but just as importantly, they like it better. It's less tiring for them, and it's also considerably faster, and so they can get the content quicker than if they were to read it in the traditional way. Now, another way of getting information into the blind person is, as I said earlier, with tape recordings or phonograph records. And there's a lot of research these days in what's known as compressed speech. Because if you, let me give you for instance, supposing that you wanted to listen to a tape of this session, and you wanted to listen to it primarily to get the content out of it. You didn't care about the pauses and the length of time it takes me to point up to the chart and all of that. You wanted all of that out of there. And you want just the content. You could do a number of things. You could remove the dead spots. Literally take a scissors and cut them out. You'd have to be careful not to remove too much of them so you'd run words together. But you could remove that. That would be alternative one. The second thing you could do is you could remove all superfluous ands and uhs and thes and and that kind of stuff. You could remove that junk out of it. Usually that happens anyway if you're going to make a professional recording from a tape or something like that. The editor does that. Now, there are some other interesting things you could do, though. There is equipment now with which you could take the content, and having trimmed out dead spaces and that kind of junk, you would then speed it up. You would speed up the message so it came through in a faster time. Rather than sitting here half an hour to listen to me, you might be able to get the same content in 10 minutes. Now, the machinery to do this is pretty complicated and exotic, because you all know what happens if you just take a typical recording and speed it up. You sound like a recording of the Chipmunks. Everybody talks way up here fast, like that. Well, obviously you wouldn't want to listen to that. But there is sophisticated equipment that will take the person's voice and leave it exactly as it is, but speed it up. And there's some very interesting research in this area. There is some research that suggests that you can speed up speech at quite a considerable level and still have it come through intelligible and understandable and enjoyable. And the threshold for enjoyment varies from person to person. Some people like it much faster than others. And depending on the content of what is on the message, you can adjust this equipment to suit yourself. You can play it back faster or slower to suit yourself. Another way you can compress speech is to pull out all superfluous words, words we call function words. And again, some people have a high tolerance for this, and you can pull out an awful lot of words without changing the message, and the person can still get the content. Now, needless to say, if you were going to take some of the stuff that Jack has written or has been presenting to you, you wouldn't want to do this, because the pauses, the extra words, the richness would be lost if you compressed it. But if you were a blind college student and you wanted to read somebody's dry textbook, and a few of them are kind of dry, I have to admit, it might be a very handy thing to do, because you could do it very quickly and still get the content. As we leave the area of blindness, let me just say one more thing to draw those two areas, namely compressed speech and braille reading, together. One of the disadvantages with a recording is that you have a hard time, if you're a blind person, going back to hear something again. You can rewind the whole tape, but that's pretty wasteful. And it's hard on a lot of equipment to find out where you are. Now, visually, they have little digital readout recorders that turn as you record, but if you can't see that, you don't know where the tape is. So for some materials, blind people do rely quite heavily on Braille, because they can go back over it again if they want to. In the area of deafness, where the visual process is sometimes intact, unless the person is multi-handicapped, we're relying a lot on what we call total communication. This is a controversial area, because the area of deafness is a very old one, and there are some people who are on one side of the fence or the other. There are some who say the only reasonable way to deal with a deaf person is to capitalize on the residual hearing, whatever they have left. And by the way, it's highly unlikely that there is any individual who is totally deaf, absolutely totally deaf. Almost everyone, with some amplification, sometimes a high degree of amplification, will be able to hear some things. And so there are individuals, there are researchers and educators who say, if we don't capitalize on what they have left, but we resort to other means of communication, then when they get out there in the real world, where an awful lot of people rely on this way of communicating, they'll be disadvantaged. There are people on the other side of the fence, however, who say, that's all well and good, but for the person who has so limited residual hearing that it's really almost non-functional, why don't we give that person alternative means of communicating? Why don't we teach that person to sign or to fingerspell? Signing is to use the hands, it's manual communication, as is fingerspelling. A sign would be a hand sign that would stand for a whole word, like you and me. That would be a whole word. Or we could fingerspell those words by using our fingers and putting the fingers in different configurations. We could spell out me and we could spell out you. By the way, I didn't use that properly because I don't know how to do it very well. So if any of you are sophisticated, I may have sworn at you and I wouldn't have even known it. Now, it's particularly important, this area of total communication is maybe particularly important for deaf infants, because we find disturbingly that deaf infants, as they grow into childhood and as they mature into adulthood, fall farther and farther behind in school. It's very typical for a high school graduate to be 3 to 4 years behind in reading level as compared with a normal peer, even though his intelligence is okay. And we frequently find, too, that the communication, the verbal output of deaf individuals is not always very understandable or enjoyable for that person to use. So another colleague of mine got the bright idea that maybe infants needed total communication input, at least in the early periods of life, until people could really figure out how much residual hearing there was there and what kind of preferences that child had later on for communicating one way or another. So he taught parents who had deaf infants to use total communication with them. That is, he didn't cut them off from verbal communication, which would have been, I think, an error, but as the parent stood over the crib, he or she would speak to the child and at the same time would sign or fingerspell right under his or her chin, so that the child would get both auditory input, if he had any, and visual input as well, because it was known that the children had the V intact. The visual was there. That research is not completed yet. It looks pretty exciting. He's finding that the children are not only better in communicating orally, that is, with their voices and understanding what other people say, but also they speak using better language. Frequently, a deaf person will telegraph his speech. He'll drop out function words because he can't hear them, and if you can't hear something, it doesn't have much meaning, doesn't have any meaning. And so their talk will be telegraphic, you know, like, dear mom, stop. Come home, I need you. You won't have the conjunctions and the function words and things in there because it costs money if you drop those into a telegram. Well, a deaf person drops those out of his speech frequently, too. Okay, so that's an exciting area of research. We know that if deaf people who have very little residual hearing do not, that some of them, after living in a listening and speaking society for a while, will get so frustrated by it, some now, not all, that they will go into their own communities. And so in large cities like New York City and Chicago, I don't think Minneapolis, I don't think it's large enough, have communities for the deaf where they can communicate however they see fit. Usually a lot of it is manual communication because they have sort of given up on the real world need to communicate with language, with verbal language. Okay, now, let's leave deafness and bump right over into retardation. There's a lot of interesting research in this area, a lot of it because this is the area of my interest primarily, and so I'll be spending a little more time in it than the other two because it's a little more familiar to me. There's some interesting research around that says that if you put two compatible sensory areas together, you might get more for your money. Now we know that when we cause senses to compete with one another, that we can get ourselves into trouble. You and I become very facile, very, very good at listening to something and writing it down. Hearing combined with kinesthesis and tactuality. No problem. We've become so good at it that we can take notes, we can listen with one ear, take notes fluently without any problem at all. For some children, that causes a problem because some people have claimed that that's those are two channels that may be in conflict in some people. And so they say that hearing and action may be in some people compatible and may not be, and that we ought to worry more about how we have people react or how we have people do what we want them to do. Maybe in a lecture, instead of your taking notes, you ought to just record it. Some people do that, and they find that they get more out of it, that they lose too much if they're busy writing, that there is a conflict there. It turns out that retarded children, on the average, not all now, but a lot of them, do pretty well, as do you, with listening and with motor activity together. And so there has been a curriculum put together for retarded children called Do and Say, where one sensory process reinforces the other. Where the child, for example, in walking across a balance beam, which looks like a chunk of railroad track, sort of, as he walks across that, he says what he's doing, or he may count his footsteps. And the two processes, for some children anyway, complement each other. And you also get more for your money. The child is learning some numbers at the same time that he's learning some balance and dynamic action. So there's a lot of research going on in that area, some very interesting stuff, and I think it will prove to be very fruitful. We're using something similar to that in our own early intervention study, our own early education study, where we're employing, I'll get to that later. That's this, and I'll get to it right now. There's nothing sacred about this sequence of this list. Another way that you can use multi-channel input is to use a stream of language or a stream of learning in ways that will give the child more than one kind of input. And so we've been using rebuses put up on little cards like these. Because we know that for the child to learn to read, the sentence says, walk to the window. Now, if you wanted to teach the child to learn to read that, as you and I probably learn to read, you could use probably two methods or combinations thereof. You could use a sight word reading method, where you would take the words as they're normally printed and teach the child to recognize those by sight. You could, on the other hand, present the words and have the children decode those letter by letter or piece by piece, and we would call that phonics. Now, depending on when you grew up, you were probably in one of those or in another, because education tends to be very faddish. When I grew up, they were using phonics. Then later on, people said, oh, it takes too long to decode words. Let's have people recognize them by sight. And so there was an era of sight reading. Now we're back into phonics again, probably for a longer period of time, because the research is fairly convincing that phonics is a necessary skill to come in fairly early in the reading process. that children will indeed learn some sight words, like they'll learn their own name. That'll come very early, and they may learn some other sight words that they see frequently, like cat, something like that, which they'll recognize. But later on, in order for children to really learn how to read pretty well, they need to begin to decode those words, to know what the letters say and to know what the letters sound like. Well, for the young retarded child, learning that a cat, a picture of a cat, and C-A-T have relatively the same meaning is a gigantic conceptual jump. It is for us, but we don't make it with too much difficulty usually. But for the retarded child, that's an enormous jump, because there's no way that you can take the picture of the cat and make it into C-A-T. You can't take one representation and match it with a word. Some people, by the way, are working on that, and I have seen some reading methods now where they're trying to make words correspond to the letters. For example, the word cat would have, as a sight word, would have fur on it. Well, there are some problems with that. We have to be careful that we don't limit the person's vocabulary so much that the only way he can recognize cat is with fur on it. And if he comes to the word bat, I guess bat, I don't know if bats have fur or not, where the fur is gone and the only thing that's different is the initial consonant, he may be in trouble. Well, how do you give kids an initial sight vocabulary that can be kind of fun for them, because you want to get them in the habit of reading in quotes left to right, because in our country that's the way we read. In China you wouldn't read that way. I think in China they read right to left, if I'm not mistaken. But in our country it's a habit, a societal convention that we read left to right. So we need to get people in the habit. Another thing we want children to do is to drop in function words, because retarded children frequently telegraph their speech, as do deaf individuals. They'll leave out words like a and the and so forth, and so you get a contracted kind of language. And you also want to make it fun. And so with these materials, the child learns to read the pictures, although some of the function words that are very, very hard to represent pictorially. How do you represent the in a picture? You just use it as it is. And you just recognize that the child will have to somehow memorize that as a sight word. And they do. And so the child, if I had a videotape equipment here, I could show you three-year-old Down syndrome children in our preschool project reading these sentences. So you get the visual, hearing them, because they're speaking and listening at the same time, obviously. Kinesthesis comes about because when the child is finished reading the sentence, he goes and does what it says here. And so you can make a lot of fun out of this. No smell and no taste to it, which isn't very important anyway. But you can see how many channels you're employing here. Also, for the purpose of getting the child into reading earlier, you can begin to use a process we call fading. Fading, F-A-D-I-N-G. You can fade in words and fade out pictures. You can fade in the word walk, W-A-L-K. And the way you would do that is, for a long time, you would have the two words together. And then once the child had mastered this and could tell you at an instant that that was the word walk, then gradually you could put W-A-L-K in there, and gradually the picture would get smaller and the word W-A-L-K would get bigger, until finally W-A-L-K was there, the picture was gone, and the child would have the word walk. And it works very well. Okay, so that's one of the exciting things that we're using with retarded children in our project. There's also a lot of hardware around, not only for the deaf, as I indicated to you, but also for the retarded. And I'm just going to give you a few examples of that. This piece of equipment is called playtest. It's an instrument that looks like the thing that President Ford probably carries around, the big black box, or the little black box. It's about this big, and it's nothing but a bunch of circuits and circuit breakers and dials and buttons and knobs. But it has a very useful purpose. It seems that handicapped children frequently don't have an awful lot of appetite for their environment. This is especially true in institutions for retarded children. That is, even if there are lots of people around, they don't interact very frequently. Now, one of the ways to extend the environment to the child is to make it available to him at his disposal, not as an intrusion. Now, I want to make that very clear. We don't want to turn on a tape recorder and have it coming into his crib or playpen out of his control, because that would be bad, and we'd run the risk of drowning him with too much stimulation. And after a while, the child would turn it off in his head. So what we can do is we can connect the tape recorder to some switches. We'll ignore the black box in between here for the moment. We can connect the tape recorder to two switches. These are called bottle switches or button switches, which can be fastened on the child's crib. And the child, by making a very gentle touch on this in any position and with any amount of pressure and using his head or his elbow or his finger, will activate the tape recorder. This is nothing more than a switch that's got a long cord on it for the tape recorder. The reason why there are two out there is that very early in the child's life, he can begin to make a choice. He can begin to express a preference. If he presses this switch, maybe he'll hear Happy Birthday. If he presses this switch, maybe Jack Ledbetter or Brahms Concerto. For the baby, they probably wouldn't care much to hear Jack. It's only later on when you have a little sophistication and can appreciate the marvelous things Jack does that you would appreciate it. For the baby, that has no meaning yet. It would probably turn out to be a neutral stimulus, by the way, as would this lecture. The child would press it a little bit just to see if there's anything there, and then he would go over to Happy Birthday and spend almost all of his time on it. Happy Birthday, by the way, if the child has had the experience of birthdays, is extremely meaningful and interesting to a child. I have a colleague who tells me that he had an emotionally disturbed young child who had had several birthdays and had sisters and brothers with birthdays, and he would listen to Happy Birthday until his mother, in desperation, would finally have to shut the equipment off because she was going bananas. He would hold the button and listen to it for hours and hours and hours. Incredible. Now, the reason the black box is in the middle is it gives us a little added advantage in being able to teach the young child something. With the black box, we can, for example, cause the channels to switch automatically after a minute or five or ten, if we want to, so that the child has to learn that if he's had Happy Birthday on the right and he likes it a lot, that at a given time when he presses and he gets Jack Ledbetter instead, that he has to learn to go left. And then he'll have it on the left for a while, and then it will come on the right. You can see it's a very gentle but definite way of teaching children to discriminate in their environment. You can also do other things with it. You can cause a latency in the switch. You can, for example, program the switch so that Happy Birthday will only come after the child holds it down for 5 seconds, that he can't get it by just hitting it and letting go right away. This again teaches the child to come into definite contact with his environment. And lest you think that this is something that the child does not enjoy, let me assure you that the child does. Most children do. Most children get a heck of a kick out of programming their own environment, out of manipulating and controlling their own environment, just like we do.
It gives them a feeling of appropriate kind of power.
This equipment has also been used in burn hospitals. That's an extremely interesting application, one we hadn't thought of originally. Sometimes, I remember a young child who was burned very, very badly and had to be immobilized while the healing process occurred. And he couldn't move anything except, I guess, the ends of his fingers. And so a colleague of mine hooked up a TV set, and the child could then control the TV set by very gently pressing these buttons. And by putting several buttons out there, he could change channels at his convenience and turn it off when he wanted to. I think that's kind of a neat application of it. It means that the child doesn't have to rely on the nurse. He can do it himself. And again, that's appropriate kind of power to have. I'm going to have to leave some of this out because I want to give you a chance to talk and to ask questions. Let me just mention these three things quickly and then we'll quit. We'll exclude this one. Sometime I'll tell you about this experiment. This is not one of those rakes that they use at Reno or Las Vegas to get in their money. This was used to rake in M&Ms, and I'll explain that experiment sometime if you're interested, or I'll explain it to you today if you want to talk about it. But let's talk about these two. Task analysis is something that's going on a great deal in special education, and it's essentially an attempt to break down tasks into steps, to analyze them literally. If you're going to teach a child to brush his teeth, wash his face, use a spoon, dress himself, there are lots of steps, and they all come in a sequence. And by observing people go through those acts, you can break the task down very, very minutely if you want to, and then you can teach it to the child step by step. Now, we don't do things step by step, and we don't even, in putting on our own clothes, for example, in putting on slacks or trousers, we do them without thought. They're at a reflex level. They're as ordinary. You don't have to think about, do I put my left leg in first? You do it automatically. But you can task analyze that problem because retarded children may have difficulty learning the steps. Now, you can use two procedures. You can use what's called shaping, where you lay the trousers out in front of the child, and then by sort of prompting him a little bit, you'll hope that eventually he'll get them on. Or you can use what's known as backward chaining. You can put his trousers all the way on except for snapping the top button. And then that becomes the final step in the whole act, and then work backwards. Backward chaining is getting to be a very popular method of instruction and is very useful. And there are oodles of people around task analyzing everything we do and writing them down in programs so that other people can teach retarded children to use them. One more thing about reading and then I'll quit. Just as you can program a task like this, dressing, you can also program reading it to some extent. One of the popular programmed readers is called the Sullivan series, and what it is an attempt to have the child be able to correct himself if he makes a mistake. Now, the Sullivan reader controls the difficulty of the vocabulary, and so you have words like cat, hat, bat, rat, sat, so forth. You're just changing initial consonant. Later on in the program, you change final consonant. And then eventually you'd add plural, you'd enrich vocabulary, you'd do the kind of thing that you would do if you were using a regular basal reader, which is the kind of thing that you and I learned with, but the vocabulary wasn't controlled very well. To some extent it was, because we'd have readers that went see, Jane, run, run, Jane, run, 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 run. Now that's very boring to us, but little kids frequently get thoroughly enamored with that kind of stuff, so don't ever knock it too much, because some little kids really like that, because the vocabulary is controlled, lots of repetition, and they can really get into it and master it, and we all like to master things. So here you see a sentence, see the, and then you're giving the initial consonant, and the child has to supply right in A and T. Same thing with A and T here for hat. Now on this side, he has a screen that goes across, which he controls himself. And as he fills in A, T, he goes across on this side and opens up a little window for himself, and he sees the word cat, and he knows he's right. Doesn't require the teacher to tell him, he knows it. If he's wrong, he can correct it on the spot. And so this kind of material, if the child can get into it well enough, almost does the teaching for the teacher. She has to come around and check the work and make sure he hasn't blown it someplace. But it's pretty well self-instructional and avoids errors that are needless. And that's quite an advantage. Okay, I'm going to stop now and let you ask questions.
One question. You said that many retarded children telegraph their speech, I'm assuming it's young children. Can you reverse that statement and say, many children who telegraph their speech are retarded?
No, I wouldn't want to say that. No. Yeah, it can be, sure. No, I wouldn't want to reverse that. No. Because there are deaf people who are not retarded, definitely not, who are very bright, who telegraph their speech too.
Well, I know you were saying that, but I mean, barring physical disabilities, if you have someone.
No, I still wouldn't want to do it. No. Yes?
With your task analysis, what was the reasoning behind, again, reversing the task? And could you give us another example of that?
Sure. Sure. I'm glad you asked that. If you decide that you're going to start the child off from the shaping point, the beginning point, which is the way, I'm glad you didn't drop it over the balcony, which is the way that we learn most things, you run into the risk that the child may never get to the final thing. He may bog down somewhere in here. Whereas if you take the final act, then the child has done everything except that last tiny step, and you would then move him backwards from it. The next step would be to pull the waistband together before you snap it. The next one would be to pull the waistband to the hips. The next one would be to put the right leg in, maybe, and then the left leg in. Until finally, you can work him back to here where he's just picking up his trousers. So you as a teacher would work from here back to here rather than from here up to here.
With the goal as the final.
Yeah. That's right. That's a good way of expressing it. You immediately get to the finished product and work backwards from it.
That's the best way I found for teaching foreign languages to elementary school kids, too. If you have a sentence you want them to say, start with the last word. When they can say that, you tack on the one before, and anybody will work their way back into a
consistent sentence. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. See, it also has motivational value. If you bog down in this, you may lose your motivation. It's not very reinforcing to be in here and you can't get to here. But if you've actually done it, sure, with lots of help, you, as Barnum used to say, you've seen the elephant. And you can kind of work backwards from that. Were you going to extend that question?
No.
Maybe we better take a different one and try and come back. Flores?
I saw an article and I wondered if you knew anything about it. Some research with a doctor's wife and their baby, and he had all his headgear on. I believe he was no sight and no hearing, and it was a sonar kind of thing.
No, I don't know anything about sonar. Do you, Carol?
I think I've read something about that. They use the bath,
right, it's a sonar kind of device.
And they're trying to teach them to get to do that.
Oh, just for input.
Yeah, he's an infant, and he knew where his mother was, and he moved his head, and he did you see that?
Yeah, it was very interesting.
He knew where it was just by this headgear, so he would have stimulus. That was the main.
There are millions of dollars going into research. And the breakthrough in that kind of thing, obviously that has severe limitations. But if you could literally figure out a way that what the child would hear could be represented in his head in some way that he could get an image of it, he would be able to get himself around in his environment without running into things. That's utopia, and there are millions of dollars of research going into that.
I wanted to comment a little bit more on your working backwards. Our choir director used to work this with us in learning anthems for church. We'd always start with the last movement and work backwards. And I've done this with my kids in learning piano also, learn the last line first, one bar at a time, because sometimes that last one. Now my question is, are those rebus cards for teaching available to the general public?
Sure, sure. The rebus cards are actually, the rebus program is commercially available from American Guidance Service. I don't have any interest in that, by the way, so I'm not trying to sell anything. The cards we're using are still in an experimental form, and they're not available. But American Guidance Service sells a whole kit. It includes cards. It also includes books of rebuses. So you can take the rebus cards and put them into this format, where the child drops in the pictures into the sentences.
Where would one obtain? Is this a company that would sell to what, general stores or school supply houses or what?
American Guidance Service, if you just wrote to them in Circle Pines, Minnesota, and just asked them for your catalog, for their catalog, they would send it to you.
Good.
Yes?
I'm interested in language intervention per se. I observed you saying something about a 3-year-old down child. You were teaching reading, some basic reading skills, and I understand that you combine then, of course, language intervention. This is part of the language intervention program. Or did the child already have a fairly basic language, verbal language to begin with?
No. Using rebuses allows you to get the advantage of both worlds. He is reading in quotes, and he's also stimulating his language. Retarded children, 3-year-old retarded children, when they're normally speaking, tend to leave out function words. In the rebus program, the function words have to go in there, and so they get in the habit of using them.
Okay, now these children that I'm working with don't have a language, per se, a verbal language. So do you read the cards, where do you start in that?
You could start with the rebus cards by acting out these.
We do a lot of modeling and target words, but sure. I've never heard of rebus cards.
Sure, you could use this. And the children would learn what you expected them to do. You might have to demonstrate for them what this means for a while until they got them. And then you could also teach them to sign and fingerspell if you wanted to.
We do some of this. I've just never heard of rebus cards. I'm relatively new in this area. So.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Maybe something like this. They put them up on the board.
Up on a pocket chart.
Oh.
Just stick them up like that, and then you can put up the next set as the children go through the activity. I don't want you to miss coffee. Carol?
How do you feel about the Illinois Faculty and Disabilities?
Well, I don't think it's terribly useful. I guess I'd want to leave my comments about it that. I don't think most people know what the ITPA is. And I think that it's been oversold as a language test. It's useful for getting an idea of verbal intelligence and can supply some teachable information, but I think there are things that are much more useful for the teacher than the ITPA.
You don't feel it's a good measure than a user.
Of these? Yes, it does, but I don't think that you need the ITPA to get an estimate of how facile the child is in these. I think you can kind of test them directly with some more functional ways. Doris?
I'm just curious. I found some children who, you know, normally that hierarchy by the time, say, they're 10, is in that order, but some very intelligent children use the last two up into, is that key to any kind of, they just haven't dropped that hierarchy into the right order or...
Give me an example.
Oh, they'll still be using, oral kinds of you know, with their pencil, or be very bright ones that seem to, with their lunch, you know, or something. And particularly I find that with some boys, you know, they just, or they smell, they just seem to, I don't know what I'm saying.
Okay.
It seems to me that they seem to have a great use of those last two, even in learning in the classroom.
Yeah.
They're very bright kids. I just wondered if some people rely on those.
Yeah.
Or do not set up that hierarchy as soon as others. That's my question.
Okay.
Is that possibility?
Well, there are a number of possibilities. The hierarchy can be different in individuals. Frequently, these things, the KTOG, become sort of carry-on. They become sort of vehicles for the person who is in these channels. And that's a very important point, and I'm glad you brought it up. There are some teachers who are overly worried about children who fidget and children who appear when they're in a lesson like seat work, where they ought really not, according to the teacher, have to use fidgeting behavior. They're pretty stern with them, and they'll say to the boy, "Stop that fidgeting." You know, they'll give them the teacher's glare that will kill a bull at 20 feet. And that's unfortunate, because there are individuals who need that a lot, and all of us need it too. You think about when you're intensely studying something or intensely listening to something, and you will find that frequently there will be some small motor behavior going on. You may be going like this. You may be drumming your fingers. People who are cut off from that possibility go bananas. And there's some research on that, where they're suspended in a pool, you know, and there's no sight, there's no sound. Their activity is reduced, and people can't stand that for more than 24 hours. So it seems like we're all programmed to have some of this stuff with us, especially kinesthesis and tactuality, as a sort of carrier. And now, that's not all without foundation in research. We know that input coming in, the so-called afferent information, which comes in what people think are electrically coded form, and the information coming out that we call motor activity, those do indeed complement one another. We used to think that those nerve channels were separate. Information came in on one circuit and went out on the other. But we know that that ain't true now, that those circuits overlap to some extent. And so it can help promote thinking if there's some motor behavior frequently. That varies a good deal across people. So don't, if you're a teacher, especially if you have young children who aren't as sophisticated as we are, and at least pretending we're listening, if they fidget, leave them alone. I've got a son, a 14-year-old, who has to do that all the time. He's not hyperactive, he's just active. And when he's eating supper, I'm constantly nagging him, because he's leaning back on the chairs, and I know they're going to collapse because they aren't as good as these. But he keeps going like this. And when he's thinking, he'll walk around the house like this. He'll walk around in circles, around and around and around the house, and it seems to help him. Also, teenagers are especially good at this, although it drives me crazy. He can play music that I would think would be incompatible with trigonometry, but he says he can't study without it. All right. So we have to be careful that we don't get too regulated on how we view other people's learning. They may need some other things that we don't.
I hope my cooking isn't here, it's not bothering
me. Not a bit. Thank you very much. Let's have some coffee.